From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 103, The Earl of Snohomish. Howard Earl Averill, also known as Earl, was the third child of Yotham and Anna Averill and was born on the 21st of May, 1902. Around 2,000 people lived in Snohomish at that time, and First Street wasn't even paved yet. Nothing is known about Averill's early life other than the fact that he played baseball on a field that the villagers had cleared of rocks and tree stumps. Equipment was basic, and organization was poor. There is a good chance that the players on the field were using handmade balls fashioned from shoe leather. Averill excelled at baseball, but quit playing at age 15 due to having a dead arm, which prevented him from throwing from the outfield. His older brother, Forrest Pudd Averill's greenhouse, was where he worked a number of jobs after quitting school around the same time. He also worked in timber mills and construction for a spell. The Snohomish town team known as the Pilchuckers was established in 1920 and took its name from the local Pilchuck River. One of the people asked to try out was Averill. That same year, Earl was invited to try out for the team and made it easily, playing for the Pilchuckers for several seasons. Around this time, he also met the woman that would become his wife and lifelong partner, Loette Hyatt. When the couple said their vows on the 15th of May, 1922, Earl was 19 and she was 16. The couple would have four sons, Howard, Bernard, Earl Douglas, who had a respectable baseball career himself and which I'll talk a little more about later on in the episode. Locals believed Averill could play baseball so much that they paid for his transportation to the Seattle Indians training facility in San Bernardino, California in 1924 so he could try out. He was told he wasn't good enough to play in the Pacific Coast League and was then dismissed. Averill moved to Bellingham where the town team took him on and helped him get a job in county maintenance after he was embarrassed by failing the tryout with the Indians. He batted around .269 in an unremarkable season before playing a few preseason games with Everett. In 1925, Averill's baseball career saw quite a significant turn. He was back in Bellingham for another season, and this go-around he ended up batting over .400. These days, a batting average of over .300, or 3 hits for every 10 at-bats, is regarded as pretty good. Shoot, as a Mariners fan, just having someone bat over .300 at this point would be downright magical, not half the team batting around the Mendoza line and leading the league in strikeouts. Anyways, the San Francisco Seals, a dominant club in the Pacific Coast League, took notice of the substantial increase in his average. He was dispatched by the Seals to Anaconda, Montana, where he was there to play for the local club while being paid to work in a smelter as well. He tore up that league as well, hitting more than .400 once more and taking his team from last place to just one game out of first at the end of the season. He then traveled to the San Francisco region to play in the California Winter League, which was semi-professional in those days. Earl was invited by the Seals to their 1926 spring training camp. Using an Oldsmobile he later characterized as being quite old, he traveled at his own expense, and this time his tryout was successful. The Seals signed him to a contract and made him their center fielder despite having a surplus of outfielders. In each of the subsequent three seasons, his batting average was greater than .300. He had a startling league-high 173 runs batted in 1928, the year that the Seals won the league title. During games played around the Los Angeles area that season, he raked for an astounding 500. Even though he hadn't had any instruction, by that point it was obvious he had major league skill. "I never received much instruction from anyone. When it came to the basics, you were on your own," Earl stated in an interview with Gene Johnston for the Seattle Times in 1974. "Really, nobody ever taught me anything." The American League's Cleveland Indians purchased Averill from the Seals after the 1928 season. Just think about that irony for a second. The minor league Seattle Indians flatly told Earl that he didn't have what it takes to make their team, while the major league Indians thought the opposite. What a mistake that was for the team that would eventually change their name to the Rainiers. Although accounts of the transaction differ, it was commonly believed that the Indians paid $50,000 for his services. Averill said that he earned $10,000 in salary and bonuses that year. "At the time," he added, "I felt it was a fairly decent salary. I was concerned that I might not get inside the club. The Indians said that I wasn't large enough, I was the team's smallest man. While he may have been smaller than others, Earl was known for his muscular body and protruding forearms, which led to his teammates giving him the nickname Rock. Nonetheless, several people were initially concerned about his height. "You paid all that money for a midget?" observed Indians owner Alva Bradley to general manager Billy Evans upon first seeing Averill. "Wait till you see him with the shirt off," Evans retorted. Averill made his big league debut when he was only 1 month away from turning 27. Opening day was on the 16th of April, 1929. Averill hit a home run in his first at-bat against Detroit pitcher Earl Whitehill. Instantly putting himself in the history books of the American League, he became just the second rookie player to ever hit a home run to begin his American League career. Sports scribes fall into ecstasies over playing and hitting of Averill was a headline that appeared in the Everett Herald on the 18th of April, 1929. The title was false in that no sports journalists were mentioned, but it captured Cleveland's manager Roger Peckinpah's attitude. "He's the best-looking young player to come up here in a while." With a .332 batting average, 97 runs batted in, and a team-high 18 home runs, Averill ended his rookie season on a high note. He was given a pay raise to $12,000 per year for his performance. "It was a lot of money for a second-year man," Earl was quoted as saying to the Seattle Times, "but I could hit with the best of them and I was the fastest in the league going down to first, yes, and in the field too." The Indians had a real star for their money. Averill batted .339 and had 119 runs batted in during his second season in the majors, improving even more over his successful rookie campaign. He also has the distinction of being the first player in the major leagues to hit 4 home runs in a doubleheader in September of 1930. He ended the day with 11 runs batted in, which is still a record in the American League to this very day. He hit .333 and had career highs for home runs 32 and runs batted in 143 in 1931. He once more hit 32 home runs in 1932. The Boston Red Sox walked him 5 times in a row during one game because they were intimidated by him as a batter. Later, the legendary Ted Williams of Boston, one of baseball's all-time best hitters, compared Averill to 2 other great players. According to Williams, he was treated with the type of reverence normally given for imposing specimens like Jimmy Fox and Lou Gehrig. Averill participated in the first All-Star game in 1933, representing the American League together with Fox, Gehrig, and Babe Ruth, among numerous other legends of their day. That was the first of Averill's 6 consecutive All-Star game selections, solidly placing him among the greatest players in the history of the game, in my opinion, though Earl's story has mostly been forgotten these days. It was a time of rail travel, massive ballpark dimensions, and loose flannel uniforms. 460 feet separated the deepest point of center field's fence from home plate when Averill joined the Indians, who played their home games in League Park. The right field foul line was just 290 feet long, but the screen separating the spectators there was 40 feet tall. Starting in July of 1932, the Indians played home games in Cleveland Municipal Stadium, which featured an even larger center field. It was 470 feet long, which is 60 feet longer than Progressive Field, where the now Guardians have played since 1994. Averill did well in both environments. While never exceeding 170 pounds in weight, he preferred using hefty bats, some of which were as heavy as 44 ounces. Instead of holding the bat at shoulder height like most batters do while he awaited the pitch, he did it at a low angle. 3 former pitchers who were among Averill's teammates in Cleveland provided descriptions of his hitting approach. Mel Harder: "When he hit the ball, it looked like a golf ball. He'd hit them in any park. League Park wasn't that easy for homers because of the 40-foot wall. He hit a lot of liners against the wall that would have been homers somewhere else." Mel Hudlin: "He was what we called a swing hitter. He swung the bat like a broom, didn't use much wrist. There were very few who hit like that." Al Milner: "He had great timing, and it was his nature to hit it through the middle." The most infamous victim of this habit of his was future Hall of Fame pitcher Dizzy Dean, who was pitching for the St. Louis Cardinals at the time. Averill broke his toe at the 1937 All-Star Game in Washington, D.C. when he knocked one of Dean's pitches back at him. After that, Dizzy Dean was never the same. Dean's pitching action was altered as a result of the injury, which resulted in arm issues and ultimately led to his career's end. On the base paths, Averill's competitiveness was evident as well. After his retirement, he later reflected that the majority of his doubles were singles, which he stretched into doubles with his speed. Singles were enough for some batters, but not for the Earl of Snohomish. These characteristics worked together to confuse opponents. A Hall of Fame pitcher for the New York Yankees named Lefty Gomez once stated, "Whether New York was at Cleveland or Cleveland was at New York, you were hoping he had a bad back or something. Earl could hit me in a black tunnel with the lights out." Averill had a better batting average than 300 in each of his first six seasons, but 1935 was a tougher year for him due in part to an injury at a picnic. He was throwing firecrackers with his sons. One that hadn't gone off detonated in Averill's right hand as he picked it up, ripping skin from his fingers and palm and igniting his forehead and chest. He missed a few regular season games as well as the All-Star game due to the injury. He finished that season with a below average for him 288, but recovered to have possibly his best season in 1936. He collected 232 hits, which was the highest in the majors, and a career-best batting average of 378. His hometown simply loved it. As longtime Snohomish resident Keith Gilbertson Sr. recalled, during the Depression, this town didn't have much pride, but we always had Earl Averill. No matter what was going on at the time, you knew you could pick up the paper every morning and see how many hits Earl Averill got. Averill was identified in 1937 as having a congenital spine deformity, which temporarily paralyzed his legs. Another below-average season was the result of the condition, which made him slower in the field and required him to change his hitting technique. He nevertheless played in 156 games. He recovered in 1938, hitting .330, but he missed 20 games. It was clear to all that his body was beginning to deteriorate. The Indians recognized him with an Earl Averill Day ceremony and a $2,400 Cadillac present as one of the greatest players in team history. In front of nearly 37,000 jubilant spectators, he completed a lifetime victory lap while riding on its fender around the cinder track at Cleveland Municipal Stadium. Soon after, he would leave Cleveland. Earl was dealt by the Indians to the Detroit Tigers almost a month into the 1939 campaign. At the time, he was only hitting .273 with one home run, and he finished his poorest major league season with Detroit that year, hitting just .262. Although only a part-time player, he helped the Tigers in their 1940 league championship victory. Averill began the 1941 campaign with the Boston Braves of the National League at the age of 39. On the 25th of April 1941, the Braves released him after just 8 games, officially putting an end to his major league career. He would then sign with the Seattle Rainiers and completed the 1941 season with them, aiding them in capturing the Pacific Coast League title. He then returned to his Snohomish home. Averill, who had retired from baseball, co-owned the family greenhouse, Averill Floral, until 1950, when he and Louette purchased a motel, which they maintained for the following 20 years. Baseball was never far from his thoughts, especially after his son Earl Douglas Averill, also known as Earl Jr., began his own major league career with the Cleveland Indians in 1956. In his college days, Earl Jr. had been a standout player at the University of Oregon, good enough to earn him a spot in the state's Sports Hall of Fame. He split 7 seasons between 4 different teams, largely as a catcher, and had a lifetime batting average of .242, a respectable mark. After 2 minor league seasons in Seattle, where his father could easily make almost every game, he completed his playing career in 1965. The younger Averill admitted, "I tried to follow in my father's footsteps, and that was a mistake since there was no following him." Averill left the motel business in 1970 and spent his free time fishing, playing poker, and watching television broadcasts of major league sports. He also questioned his exclusion from the Baseball Hall of Fame. Many others were questioning this as well, particularly in his own state, the Evergreen State. A push to get him picked included an Earl Averill Day proclaimed by Washington Governor Dan Evans and Earl Averill Appreciation Night, a dinner presentation in Everett that drew over 400 people. The Earl of Snohomish had a distinct bearing and presence even 33 years after his final baseball season. In 1974, Gene Johnston provided the following description for the Seattle Times. "Only about 5 feet 9 inches and 175 pounds, he's one of those superbly built men with a drill sergeant carriage who seem to get taller and broader as they approach. He was called Rock in the big leagues, and it's hard to believe he's 72 years old." Johnston's story was titled, "Why Isn't Earl Averill in Baseball Hall of Fame?" One explanation for the question was that some voters believed his fielding was not Hall of Fame worthy. The septuagenarian bristled at the thought. "I could do it all. Don't kid yourself," he said. "I'll admit that around once a season my back would give me real trouble. I have a congenital defect that hampered my bending down, but I could field with anyone." He had been eligible for 29 years when the call finally came. On the 3rd of February, 1975, a special committee formed to consider old-timers overlooked in the regular Hall of Fame balloting. They ended up voting unanimously to include Averill. Warren Giles, former National League president and head of the committee, called to give him the news. "My ambition is reached. I really longed for this," Averill told the Associated Press. To a Seattle Times writer, he said being picked unanimously kind of makes up for the long wait and added, "It's wonderful to make it while you were still alive." On the 18th of August, 1975, Averill was formally admitted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, being the first player from Washington State to receive that honor. He has since been joined by two other native Washingtonians, the great Ryan Sandberg of Spokane in 2005 and Ron Santo of Seattle in 2011. Averill's wife, their four sons, their daughters-in-law, and their grandkids attended the event in Cooperstown, New York, together with Earl. His acceptance speech had a hint of malice about it. "I was convinced I was qualified to be a member, but apparently statistics alone are not enough to gain a player such recognition. Had I been elected after my death, I had made arrangements that my name never be placed in the Hall of Fame." Averill was also recognized by the Cleveland Indians. He was the third Cleveland player to have his jersey number retired when it was done. "They told me I was the greatest player ever to wear their uniform," Averill said. "I thanked them, but I didn't believe it." Averill went to Comiskey Park in Chicago to attend the 50th All-Star Game on the 6th of July, 1983. The final 13 of the original 33 All-Stars were honored as part of the anniversary celebration. He was miserable when he returned home, though. "I think it bothered Dad that so many of his buddies had passed away," Earl Averill Jr. said. He knew he was getting older. He had a real good time in Chicago, but when he got back, he was really down. Earl Averill was admitted to Providence Hospital in Everett on the 11th of July with pneumonia. He was unable to return home because of worsening respiratory issues. He died on the 16th of August, 1983, and was buried in the Grand Army of the Republic Cemetery in Snohomish. His obituary appeared in publications all around the nation. The Everett Herald had this to say: "A great player became part of history yesterday. Earl Averill left us with a long trail of his achievements worthy of his Hall of Fame status, a bevy of notable feats, statistics that are unmatched by even some of history's greatest players, and enough memories to keep the old-timers talking a long time." Averill was named the greatest athlete in Snohomish County history by the Herald in 2005. That was no insignificant distinction, as shown in 2010 by the individuals in the County Sports Hall of Fame's inauguration class. In addition to Averill, they included Chris Chandler, a former University of Washington quarterback who spent 17 years in the National Football League, Dennis Erickson, a former Washington State University football coach who won two national championships at the University of Miami and also served as the head coach of the National Football League's Seattle Seahawks, Marv Harshman, a college basketball legend who coached at Pacific Lutheran University, WSU, and UW. Rosalind Sumners, an Olympic silver medalist in figure skating, Anne Quast, one of the most dominant female amateur golfers in American history, and All-American George Wilson, who some consider to be the greatest UW football player ever and who was also the subject of episode 39. Cleveland contributed to Averill's remembrance. When Jacobs Field, later dubbed Progressive Park, opened in 1994, he was among the former players recognized with permanent displays. The first row of the Indians' Ring of Fame is made up of the franchise's Hall of Famers and runs inside along the outfield wall. Averill and the other players who have been named among the 100 greatest in franchise history have plaques outside on the bowed brick wall of the park's lower level. When the park opened, Earl Douglas Averill represented his father and received a framed facsimile of Averill's number 3 Indians jersey. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include the Society for American Baseball Research, baseballhall.org, baseballreference.com, the Baseball Almanac, the Snohomish Historical Society, MLB.com, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Everett Herald, the Seattle Times, HistoryLink.org, and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Thank you for listening to episode 103, The Earl of Snohomish. Episode 104 will be released next week. A special thanks goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets and on the Hull. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck, the singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck, and Moclips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.